Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
I'm your host, Bill Patton. What is Infinite Tennis? It's the show that we run if we can remember to run it. It's you getting your voice. It's you listening to other people have their voice. Don't test that, you know. So that's me getting all Eddie Murphy on the rap there. So today on the show we have Brent Abel, who's another in the line of the Tom Stowe disciples that we've been reaching out to. And I'm sure he's going to have a completely different take because Tom was not dogmatic about too many things, I don't think. But he did create kind of some principles that people latched on to, and we're going to bring Brent onto the show right now. Brent, how are you doing?
Well, Bill, I'm doing well. I appreciate the time to get in your show. Now, what did you mean about being on time? Was that what was that in a reference to?
Being on time, was somebody not on time?
I was hoping you might kind of spill the beans on that one.
I will tell you this. I was interviewing Steve Johnson on Saturday, and I managed to spill my coffee all over the coffee table and onto the floor, and cleaned it up and continued the interview, and Steve didn't even know anything had happened. But I did admit at the end that I had spilled coffee all over the place. So, folks, what Brent is referencing is that I completely forgot that we were supposed to be talking at a certain time, and he called me, and I had my big aha, my big.
You know, I could see if I was a Steve Johnson type of guy, big name in the tour. You know, NCAA winner, but, you know, it's just little Brent Abel here, you know, web tennis, kind of do his own little thing, you know, blah, blah, blah.
I love it.
You know, we're a bunch of old farts, and we kind of forget this stuff from time to time. So I thought it was great.
But don't worry, it was just Steve Johnson's dad. So, you know, that's all that is. All right, so enough of the monkey business here. How did you learn how to play tennis, Brent?
Well, I was born a member of the Berkeley Tennis Club in 1948. My mom and dad were members at the time. And so I've been a life member of the Berkeley Tennis Club for 65 years. And so I just started there back in the 50s. And, you know, at the time, Tom Stowe was the club manager and head tennis professional. And I did not take any lessons from him, did not get any coaching when I was a kid. I was, you know, primarily on the baseball field 99% of the day, unless I had to go home and eat dinner and go to bed. But I did take a few lessons from, you know, a couple of his assistants, you know, when I was a young guy, probably around 8 or 9 years old. And, you know, I played enough tennis as a kid to think I could enter some tournaments when I was 14 in the juniors. I think I played Eric Van Dillen maybe 3 or 4 times that summer. Did not win one game in any of those 3 or 4 matches. And, you know, figured, you know, man, this stuff's no fun. And so I really did not have much of a junior career. I mean, I played some in high school. Went away to high school in Colorado Springs, Colorado, to what was then a private boys boarding school, small school. So, you know, back in the 60s, there was very little competitive tennis going on in the state of Colorado. So, you know, you could be a big fish in a small pond at that point, playing just 8 to 10 weeks a year. But, You know, Bill, I really didn't get going till I was around 21 years old. I mean, I came back from Colorado, went to the University of Denver, and then came back home and really started playing right around when I was 21 or so.
That's great. Hey, let's talk about baseball a little bit more. What were your primary positions that you played in baseball?
You know, my primary position was shortstop and third base. And, you know, it's you know, when we talk about Tom, about Mr. Stowe, I mean, he was smart enough to be able to relate that experience into what he was trying to show me in tennis.
You know, it's really interesting because I always love coaching a quarterback, a shortstop or a second baseman, a pitcher, a catcher, a striker or a really good defenseman in soccer, or a point guard in basketball. And I mean, I could probably go on more, but it's really interesting kind of the skill sets that those sports have that bring something positive to tennis and give you a strong basis to work with. How does that relate to what Tom does or did?
Well, you know, Tom was about balance. That was the first thing we worked on, was balance, about your posture, about how you moved on the court, about how it was much more of a elegant type of movement. And he was smart enough to kind of talk to me about how I would take how I would feel the ground ball in terms of allowing to have a certain posture, a certain balance where I'm not really fighting, I'm not sort of stumbling with my feet into the ball, more just kind of getting in position and just sort of absorbing the ball, especially off the short hop, and being able to allow it to come in rather than reaching too far out to try to catch it way out in front and be off balance. And so he talked a lot about how we posture ourselves in the ready position, how we move out of that ready position, and how we sort of address the ball from a certain posture of balance. And he was really big on that, and he wouldn't let you really do too much hitting until he was convinced that you understood this is the balance position that he was looking for. This is how he wanted you to turn and move to your right, turn and move to your left if the ball was coming directly at you, how he wanted you to turn and move away from the path of the ball. There was really a look, you know, a quote-unquote look that he was after. And, you know, he would feed me some balls, have me put my racket down and feed me some balls as if I was an infielder, tennis balls. And for me, I trained that for so long as a kid that it was just completely second nature. It was totally natural for me when he put me into a baseball mindset. And, you know, and we just sort of did the same thing. We kind of get the imaginary glove out of my hand, put the racket in there, and then from there just kind of do the same thing with the tennis ball in terms of how it related to tennis, in terms of how you moved in relation to the path of the incoming ball, how you set up. And so he really didn't talk about the class, not the classic, but the old-time tennis teaching cliches, which I had been brought up on, which were, you know, turn, racket back, step forward, make contact out in front and follow through.
Yeah.
And all of those, he never talked that way to me. He never, ever talked that way to me. And so that's really where we started. We started from a position of body balance and how you moved in the court, because if you didn't have that right, then his stroke mechanics just wouldn't work for you. And so that's where we started, and we spent a lot of time on that before we really started talking about stroke technique.
Exactly. That's interesting. You know, one thing I like to show my players is how, if my posture's good and I'm on balance and all that good stuff, how you know, here's what my stroke looks like when I do that. But if you can see me tilted with my upper body like this, look at how my stroke looks now. And then, oh, and then they go, oh, wow, that looks horrible. So it's pretty easy to see the holes in your strokes if you're, you know, if you're taking a swing when you're off balance. But now let's go back to your playing career. And when did you really start to take off as a player and you really got into it?
Well, I got a late start with getting instruction. I was at the time teaching as the head professional tennis director at the Moraga Country Club, Northern California, 1978, 79, 80, and in 1980. Before I did the begging, I was calling around asking some of the players who I had a lot of respect for who they thought if I wanted to really go see someone who could give me the real stroke mechanics, really how to hit the ball, because I'd been a player who, as I said before, brought up on the turn, racket back, contact out in front and follow through. And I tried to play that way, and I just was really, I just had no power in my game. I just had nothing. I was just a little rabbit. I was young enough at that time. 1980, I was 32, and I was, I guess, 31, about to turn 32. And I was quick enough still to be able to run around and kind of, you know, retrieve balls and kind of push them back in the court, but couldn't really beat somebody. If I won the match, they kind of lost to me. They found a way to lose, you know, to lose, but.
Yeah.
And I finally kind of got disgusted because I'd hired just recently, at the time I hired a new assistant pro, a guy I know that you know, Doug King. And Doug was at the time, I think, number one in Northern California as a player. And when he showed up on the teaching court next to me, not only did I not have a system that I could give him, but I just gave him the basketballs, and he just went out. And I just sort of listening to him teach, I knew right then and there that this guy had a system, and it was completely different than mine. And at the time, it was just coincidental. At the time, it's when I've been calling around some guys, who do you think's the best guy, blah, blah, blah. And the one guy who kept coming back was the name Tom Stowe. And I remember just going to Kinger, and I said, you know, where are you getting this stuff? And he says, well, you know, I've been working with Mr. Stowe for a couple of years. I said, all right, that's it. And I just asked him how. He said he was going to Napa to see Tom once a week in a group of two other guys, Steve Stefanke and John Hubble. And those three guys at the time were, I think, in the top seven of Northern California. And I had known Tom from the Berkeley Tennis Club days a little bit, well enough to be able to call him up, and here comes the begging part. I just begged, can I please get into this Wednesday morning group from 9 to 12 with the other three guys? And he kind of just, I don't know, maybe took pity on me or something, but he said, fine. And he let me in there, and this was in 1980, and literally the first day I saw him up there at Napa, he looked at my strokes and just, you know, at the beginning when you said, you know, he was really a character, he just said point blank, he looked me right in the eye and said, you know, you got nothing that I can work with. There's nothing you've got that will work into what I consider to be the foundation of good balance and good tennis strokes. And I think in the back of my mind, I was relieved to hear that because I was hoping that he would just sort of say, let's just start with a clean palate. Let's wipe the slate clean, and let's just start from ground zero. Because I knew that, you know, I knew in my heart of hearts, I really didn't know what I was doing as a teacher. Certainly didn't know what I was doing as a player.
You know, Brent, that's really interesting. Let's go a little deeper on that because I think there's a great lesson there for all coaches, parents, and players that sometimes you have to be brave, and you have to go, and you have to completely break something down. And I think coaches, tell me what you think of this. Coaches let players down if they don't show enough bravery in saying, I'm sorry, that forehand's horrendous. We have to start from scratch. I totally agree. Do you think less players down if they kind of try to massage their strokes when what they need is to build real fundamentals?
I think if you're a tennis teaching professional or coach, and you're really honestly trying to help players become better, rather than just looking at people with a dollar sign on their forehead and go, well, for the next 60 minutes, this guy's worth, you know, $100. I don't know, $75, whatever it is. And I think if you come from that posture where you're so confident that you've got a system that you know works, and it's probably a system that you haven't had to invent yourself. You probably got it from someone else, or you put it together from a couple, two or three other really legendary guys who knew what they were doing. Yeah, I absolutely think it's your duty to go out and be completely honest with someone and let them know that, you know, I wouldn't do it any more the way that Mr. Stowe did it. I mean, he was brutal. And you know, a lot of people would not go back to see him because you had to, and for whatever reason at that point in my life, I was ready for it. I was ready to get abused. And he was the right guy for me. I'm not saying he was the right guy for everybody. And I certainly, you know, I don't have his personality, and I wouldn't tell someone the way he would tell someone that you don't have anything I can use. I think I would find a little bit more of a positive way to say it now. But you're absolutely right, Bill. I think if coaches and tennis pros are not being completely honest with people and not worrying about what the outcome of that honesty is going to be, what the result's going to be, because it might be someone says, well, I'm going to go somewhere else.
Yeah.
You know, if you've got that posture, if you've got that confidence, and I don't mean in a cocky way, but I just mean that belief in your system, in your tennis system, teaching system, then you have to be honest with people and let them know. And so I totally agree with what you just said.
You know, I don't do this often, but every once in a while I feel compelled to tell the player that the way you hit that serve is so far off from what I'm teaching that I respectfully ask you to never tell anyone that I taught you that. And sometimes, you know, and sometimes I'll even tell a player that, hey, until you get to the point where you're able to do X, you know, regularly, then I don't really think of you as being my player yet. You know, and so on the other hand, I tell them, hey, look, you know what? Now you've done it, and great. So now you can call yourself someone who's been coached by me, and I really, really appreciate all the hard work that you've put in there. You know, so there's a lot to be said about the integrity of the coach and not letting the player off the hook from learning what's going to be best for them. You know, I
agree.
I'm reflecting back on the kid who learned the frying pan serve sometime in his early development and played with it for years and years before I got him, and I just simply was not able to teach him a proper serve in a number of years. And I just said, please, never tell anyone that you took lessons from me. So, I mean, you know, we have a few failures out there. I mean, I don't know that any tennis pro has ever been 100% successful.
Yeah, that's just human nature. It's never going to be that way. I want to add one more thing about Tom, and that when he told me that you know, you don't have anything I want, and basically I said, you know what, I'm glad to hear that. You know, I'm all yours. And it took a while before he finally came around and he told me that he wasn't trying to make me into a mold where I looked like every other quote-unquote Tom Stowe student. He didn't want that label put on individuals. What he did want is he wanted to show us what he believed was a system of fundamentals, a system of balance. And that once you got those, then he wanted you to take your own unique personality, lay it down on top of those fundamentals, and go. And if that meant that you were a baseline guy, then that's what you were. You had the fundamentals, and you were a baseline guy. If that meant that you were a serve and volley guy, you had his fundamentals, but you laid his but you laid your own personality down on top of it, and that's what he wanted. He really didn't, you know, he wasn't an ego type of guy where he said that, well, I want everyone to look a certain way so that everyone knows that when they look at that player, ah, oh, there's a Tom Stowe guy. That was not him.
Yeah, that's a great clarification that you just made. And, yeah, far be it from me to want to get my giant cookie cutter out and make I think what you said captures what I was trying to say much better. So, but, yeah, that the player then has developed their own style based on who they are and what their strengths and weaknesses are. So now, besides Tom, were there some other influential coaches that helped shape your coaching philosophy?
You know, I did, in terms of stroke technique, no, there were not. I did sort of dive into some material, some of the mental side from Jim Lohr.
Yeah.
And he really kind of articulated and detailed for me what my between points routine is, what that four-part routine is.
Yeah.
And because, you know, Mr. Stowe's way of mental toughness was, well, God damn it, just take it like a man. And, well, you know, for a lot of us, that we need a little bit more, soft and fuzzy, I don't know. But so I got a lot from Jim Lohr. I mean, he really helped me, I think, manage my between points time in my matches. And then I studied a lot of the top players, in the tournaments that I played in. I mean, I you can kind of watch the pros, and I do like to watch the pros, but I kind of like to watch them play, not so much what I can get out of them because I'm going to copy them because I don't believe that we can do what they do. But at least for the older recreational senior guys who were, you know, trying to make sure they can love the game and play the game for the rest of their lives. But I've watched, I study these guys. I mean, I just study the top players. I see how they kind of walk on the court. I see how in certain big point, at least what I perceive as big point situations, you know, how do they play this point? And it's just, it's so basic. It's so fundamental. It's so stripped down to anything artificial. And that was the message that Mr. Stowe was trying to give all of us, is that, yeah, you know, guys, I'm really just, and I'll never forget this because he used to tell me this so many times when he'd look at me trying to hit a ball a certain way, he'd go, you know what? That's just artificial. That little flare there on top of the swing, that's just artificial. That's phony. And, God, it just, you know, it was kind of like the deepest cut that he could tell you, which was you were doing something that you didn't need, that you were just kind of doing it to show off. And I realized that really what he was trying to do and the way it eventually worked into my own teaching was our job as teaching pros, I think, most of the time, is to teach fundamentals in a way where we help players take away all the unnecessary stuff that they do.
Yeah, that's great.
Because I think that's why players are inconsistent at the rec level, at the non-pro level, as opposed to the pro level. I think if you could somehow measure the stroke mechanics of touring pros, you would find that they really have the quote-unquote repeatable strokes, which means that they're pretty fundamental, they're pretty basic. They can just do it in a way that we can't. I mean, they can get over the balls, foot speed that we can't. But I'll bet you those guys, the spacing they have, where they set up to the path of the incoming ball, is so much more consistent than rec players.
I think we're all over the map. I mean, if we could chart how a rec player sets themselves up to the spatial distance from the path of the incoming ball,
right?
You know, we're always either too close. We're either, you know, too far away. We're, I mean, it's rarely like, you know, a golfer who can go up there and make sure they've got the right distance away from the ball. We don't do that as well as the pros do. I think Mr. Stowe, that's why he really stripped it down to some pure basic fundamentals that mostly came out of posture and balance, because if you're not on balance, it's really tough to time the swing to an incoming ball. And so that kind of gets me back to why I think it's so important that we help players strip away the artificial stuff, get it down to the fundamentals, and so that they can repeat these things over and over and again and give them a chance to be consistent as players.
Yeah, I think there's so much truth in that. And now, one thing, let's backtrack for a second, and you mentioned the four things that happen between points from Lair, and so I'm sure there's got to be somebody out there going, wait, what are those four things? So can you run through that pretty quick?
Yeah, well, you know, I normally charge about $5,000 for this stuff, but in this case, Bill, here are the four.
You know, did I forget to tell you the check's in the mail?
That's right.
Did I?
This is really a very simple kind of system that I use between points, and I totally got it from Jim Lohr. I can't remember, you know, if I heard it, if I read it, but he definitely was the person that I heard it from. And that the moment a point is over is I try to go to the hook of a song. And what that does for me emotionally is it doesn't spike me up. If I just hit the greatest running forehand up the line pass in the history of, you know, senior tennis, I don't want to kind of jump for joy and go crazy because my emotional level gets spiked.
Yeah.
And if I've just chunked the easiest, fattest sitter up at net with the guy falling down on the other court and, you know, all I have to do is just push it anywhere in the court, and if I miss the shot, I don't want to go down to those deepest depths of, you know, you're such an idiot.
Right.
So, and I used to do that. I mean, I used to really go on the emotional roller coaster of the ups and downs. And for me, maybe this isn't for everybody, but every time if I hit a great shot, I'd go up. And subconsciously, I think my brain would tell me, this is how you play tennis, or this is how you should play tennis every point.
Yeah.
And that's just not reality. And then I'd be disappointed. Even if I won the next point, there'd be, or if I mishit a ball for a winner, they'd be going, oh, come on, man, you're so lucky, which we all know. I mean, 90% of the time we hit a ball somewhere, it doesn't go exactly where we intended it to go. So, and on the other hand, if I just, you know, missed the fattest sitter, if I went down into the, you know, deepest depths of depression, not a great way to set myself up to play the next point. So
right.
What I learned from Jim was the first thing was, and I think his was have no emotional response to whatever just happened in that point. I tried that, and that didn't really quite work for me. It was like I was kind of white-knuckling it. So what I do before a match is I'll find my song for that match, and I'm kind of partial to Van Morrison stuff, you know, old school stuff, and I might find one of his songs, and the hook to that song, as soon as the point's over, I go right to it, and I just start humming it to myself. Maybe I'm singing a few words to myself, whatever the hook is. And the next thing, too, is I go into two or three really deep control.
Let's back up on because there's,
sure,
there's something I'd like to add to that, because I think he calls that the decisive stage. And the way that I've always approached that is as soon as that point's over, to have an acknowledgement that there's closure on that point. Win or lose, that's over. And so... So I've always taught it that way, that, you know, at the end of the point, start with that point is now over, and then you have that decisive movement away from the point. Stefan Edberg, I think, is the greatest greatest example of this, and I think he was a Lehrer disciple, was that he would win, he'd hit an amazing volley winner, and then you'd see him make a 90-degree turn. Like I'm turning away from that point because it's gone. So it's, you know, I think we're looking at it from different perspectives, but I, you know, I appreciate yours, and I just wanted to throw that in there too. So let's go on to the second one.
Yeah, and I think just to back up 1 second, I mean, what the hook to a song does for me is it does exactly what you're saying. It kind of wipes the slate clean. And
yeah.
I've got no residue. I've got no residual from that last point on an emotional level. I mean, I'm really trying to keep that emotional level as even keel as possible. Thing number two is two or three really controlled deep breaths. Even if the guy has double faulted, where there's been absolutely zero exertion of energy, I am going to go ahead and make sure that I stick true to the four parts. So I go through step number two every time. And it could be just the other end of the spectrum where you've just had a really long point and you need to get some oxygen back into your system. So for me, I really focus on that on step two. Two or three very deep, sometimes a few more deep controlled breaths from my stomach, from my abdomen area, rather than trying to, you know, hyperventilate by being up too high. Thing number three is I might consider a strategy for how I want to start this point. So, for example,
yeah,
if I'm serving, I'm going to think, you know, what's my strategy here? Well, you know, it's 40-15. I've been serving to the guy's body 90% of the time. I'm going out wide. And I'm going to commit to it right there. And I'm just not going to waver from it. If I'm returning serve, it sort of depends on maybe more of a cue for me, which could be more, you know, kind of going through a reminder of really soft hands. As that toss goes up, really soft hands. Because I can't tell myself strategically how am I going to start this point because I'm not in charge. The guy's serving. But what I might tell myself is, all right, make sure hands are soft, hands are relaxed, here we go. And then,
you know,
let me
back up to number two for a second because when you're feeling nervous, then you definitely need that additional oxygen. So I think it's a good idea to take more time to breathe if you are in a situation where you're feeling some nerves coming in, you know, and then in the cues for return of serve, you know, a lot of times people make the mistake of going for too much on return. So if I'm coaching a player and they've been making a lot of mistakes on return, then I might tell them to consider just trying to put the ball back in the direction that it came, because it's going to be safer that way. And or, oh, if I get a second serve, I'm going to attack it. And this time I'd like to do it by hitting an angle if it's there. You know, so you're kind of having that caveat of, you know, when that situation arises, I'm pre-programmed. So, because I'm with you that you can't control what the server's going to do.
I think sometimes what I'll remind myself when I'm returning serve is that, especially if it's a break point, and I want to make sure that, worst case, I force this guy to play. I really want him, because he's got the pressure, he's got a break point, especially if it's a serve and volley guy. I want to make sure that I force this guy to play. I'm not saying I'm going to throw up a, you know, fat sitter, but I don't, as you're saying, I don't want to get too tight, too tense, think I got to go for anything too big. I just want to make him play. And it's weird, but, you know, most of the time on a break point, when you get the ball in play and force the guy to play, you know, good things happen. So that's one of the cues that I will remind myself in a break point, let's make him play.
Yeah, and that's a lot of pressure for the server when they know they're not going to get anything for free.
That's right.
Okay, so now what's the fourth step?
Well, the fourth step for me and is a self pump. It is a real positive. Nothing's based on outcome. Nothing's based on results. Everything is based on process. And I'm simply just telling myself, here we go. Here we go. It's kind of like I'm just making myself alert. The moment is now. Here we go. And for whatever reason, that four-part system, that four-part routine, it really helps me be a more consistent player once the point gets started. And, you know, we all know that at least the old school guys, in terms of serve and volley, that, you know, 80 to 85% of the match is between points. This day and age with the kids staying back behind the baseline and working the ball around, it's a different ratio. But I got to believe that with a 25 seconds between points, on average, most points with the younger guys aren't lasting 25 seconds. So I still believe that most of the match is between points. And I think if you manage that time well, and what I've discovered is when I practice that, because it's not like a light switch you can just turn on and off and go, okay, well, what are the four things? All right, well, here's one, two, three, four. You know, try to start a match. I could never do that. And even though I've been doing this for a long time, if I haven't played a tournament for a while, I've got to go out a few weeks before that tournament starts and start practicing that four-part routine. And when I do, and when I stay really true to it, and when I really, really am disciplined to it, even if I've lost the first set, and even if I'm down a break in the second, where now you know how that works. I mean, you're just on the verge of coming unraveled. If I will stay there and hang around long enough, I give myself the best chance of finding a way to stay close enough, maybe to grind out the second set. And then you know as well as I do, it's a whole new ballgame. So to answer your question, you know, who are the other guys that I learned from? You know, Tom Stowe's the guy. He's far and away the guy, and I will, you know, for the day I die, I give him all the credit for helping me become a player, really helping me become a much better tennis professional. Jim Lohr really helped me with that between part mental routine. And I think just sort of self-education, going out and just watching guys. I mean, I had such a great education from Tom Stowe that now I could go out and I could start to look for certain things in other players. And I could see with the top players, I go, man, they do that. Oh, my God. You know, I never knew what to look for before. Or I'd watch, you know, players that were sort of, you know, middle of the pack, and I could see that they're not doing this, or they're doing this other thing that Mr. Stowe said was, geez, Brent, that's artificial. You don't need that. And so, you know, yeah, I mean, I really haven't – I study. I love to listen to other pros. I love to hear what they've got to say. And I think it's a never-ending learning process. I think if you ever think that you figured it out, you might as well quit. But, you know, I mean, what would be the point?
Right.
So,
you know, it's interesting the relevance of Tom Stowe and his principles, you know, today and probably for all time. And, you know, it also reminds me of the book Match Play and the Spin of the Ball by Bill Tilden, and how, you know, by and large, most of that book is incredibly relevant today still. I mean, you don't have quite as many players who hit the chop, you know, anymore, but you know, people don't hit the ball flat or come to the net quite as much, but stylistically, you know, kind of the Rochambeau of this style of shot beats that style of shot beats this other style of shot. That, all of that still is true, you know, and he even said the one shot that will always be the most influential is the forehand drive. And there you have it. It pretty much still is the shot that's winning the most matches. You know, you've got to have
it. I think that, well, you know, Mr. Stowe coached Don Budge, helped him win the 1938 Grand Slam. And, you know, a lot of people, a lot of historians out there will tell you that Don Budge had the best backhand of all time. And, you know, I never saw him play, but I talked to enough players who not only saw him play but had a chance to play against him. And it was pretty much if you left a ball anywhere short in his court, it was like, you know, it was like a mountain lion just jumping on you from 3 feet. You were just in deep doo-doo. I mean, he did not let you off the hook. And he could do it with not only his forehand but also his backhand. And so I do agree with you. I think that the racket technology, and I think the string, and I think that the incredible conditioning that these guys are in.
Yeah.
And I think a different kind of athlete that we've got now. We've got a bigger, you know, a bigger human being out there than ever before. I just think they can do things that have never been done before. And with the forehand, I just think it works with all that said, all the technology, all the training, and all the different kind of athletes. The forehand is just ripe for being a massive weapon. That maybe there's no other stroke right now that can kind of match it. You're right. I mean, even Mr. Stowe was, he really looked at the forehand as an opportunity to really create some havoc. And anytime you got a short ball, and I mean, you were just on that thing, and you were hitting that thing flat as a pancake at the top of the rise, going up the line, and just looking at the guy and going, you know, go ahead, give me your best passing shot. And that was the attitude. I mean, that was just the attitude. I mean, he just had us come in and just say, fine, you can pass me twice in a row, but I really don't think you can pass me three times in a row. And in fact, I think you got X number of passing shots in your bag today, and my job is to empty that bag as soon as possible.
Yeah, and, you know, it's funny because I believe that the way to bring net play back into the game to counteract the fact that the great spin with the new strings has essentially widened the court is to make the court just a little narrower to allow net people to cover the court, cover the net better. But, you know, that's a pretty radical idea for some people. I'm thinking if the court were narrower by a foot or 2 feet, that net play would exist again, and then you also wouldn't have players who have to move dramatically diagonally backwards to cover a lot of these spun balls that are pulling them off the court. But anyway, let's move to something else. So if you had to give advice to coaches or parents or players on how to negotiate junior tennis and make their way to college or the pros, what advice would you give to coaches as they're helping prepare these players?
I think the number one thing is these kids have got to know that this is their thing. And if they don't, if they think that mom and dad are too involved, then I think you got a problem. And I've actually had to fire a couple of parents. And unfortunately, I've lost a couple of kids because the parents were just so into it that the kid could never feel that this was his or her thing.
Yeah.
And so I think the coaches have to really be sensitive to, you know, what's the relationship between mom and dad, mom and or dad and the kid? You know, is it healthy? And, you know, my last job at the California Tennis Club in San Francisco, we had a we had a good sizable junior program, and we had a couple of kids who were strong players. And I really worked more with the parents in terms of the role I want you to provide for your kids so that they can really have this thing, tennis, as their sport.
Yeah.
Is I want you to drive the car, and I want you to pay the bills, and I want you to write the check. And all I care about after that is just give them some positive. When they come off the court, they're going to lose some matches because I'm not going to teach them to be baseline-only players. I'm going to teach them a continental grip. I'm going to show them how to play a slice approach. I'm going to show them how to play a slice backhand. You know, we're going to play a lot of doubles. I am not going to set your kid up to be just a Western gripped-only forehand guy because I don't think, you know, if he doesn't make it in the tour, and we all know that how many of our juniors make it in the tour and make money, you know, none, that our job is to make sure that we help these kids love this game so they can play for the rest of their lives. And I just don't believe, you know, big-time Western forehand grips, 4 to 5 feet behind the baseline, yeah, you get results as a junior. You definitely do, and you can probably do okay in college. But the fact remains most kids now burn out, either as a junior or in college, because of one of two things. Either the parents are too involved or the kid has not been given a set of strokes, a set of fundamentals, where they can be an all-court player and they can enjoy all parts of the court. So
that's great advice. Let's shift it now a little bit because I'll take that answer as being both parts of for coaches and parents because if you're giving the coach that advice, then any parents listening, they've got a pretty clear view of what you would say to them, I'm sure. So now let's focus on the player. Let's say we have a young player and they're listening to the show and they're trying to find their way. And maybe they have a parent who's not much involved at all. You know, what would you say to them? Or they have a parent who's over-controlling. What would you advise them to do?
Well, you know, I hope it's more that the parent's erring on the side of being less involved, which, you know, may be sort of, you know, going against the grain. But I think if you've got an overbearing parent, that it's going to be really tough to help this kid feel that the tennis is really their thing. And I think we've got a real challenge. I think tennis coaches, tennis pros, tennis junior programs have such a challenge now with so many different options in terms of sports and activities that these kids can now choose from. You know, when I grew up, we didn't have all these choices. I mean, we didn't have soccer. You know, I didn't see a soccer ball until I was probably 20. I don't know, maybe older than that. So I think that we got to make sure that we find a way that this is, number one, it's fun. And so I think that you have to do some work with the parents. And I would just tell the kid that, you know, this is not an easy game. Tennis is not an easy game. And yet, when you spend some time with it and you really work at it and you become an all-court player where you're proficient in singles, you're proficient in doubles, you know, you can play a half volley, you can play a slice approach, you can volley, you can hit an overhead, you know, you can topspin drive a forehand, you can topspin drive a backhand, slice a backhand. It's fun. And I think coaches have a real challenge to make sure that they get the kid out there often enough to help them develop, you know, that toolbox of strokes. And I'll, you know, I hadn't thought about this until now, and maybe this is just total BS, but I think that in the back of a lot of coaches' minds, they realize that there's a lot of competition out there for this kid's time. And so they may be thinking, well, I got to give this kid success ASAP. And the easiest way to do it is let's move the grip over, semi-Western forehand, let's roll it up there and just outwork this kid over there. And you'll definitely get results, victories, faster that way than if you really spend time going through all the strokes. So to give a lot of coaches the benefit of the doubt on that, it's a challenge. It's really a challenge to keep these kids interested and to, at the same time, make sure that, and I've always felt that our job as a tennis pro is to, especially with juniors, is to help set them up so they have something that they can enjoy for the rest of their lives. And, and our job's not really. I just don't think our job really is to, well, can we go out and find the next great American player? I just don't think that. And I don't think that our program should be geared, you know, a junior program in general should be geared to, you know, we're trying to do that Eastern Bloc, that Eastern German thing where we're sorting through these kids and we're testing and we're finding out who's the best athletes and this and that. And, you know, and maybe my philosophy is the reason that we have so few good American players in the pro tour right now. I don't know. But I really believe that our job as tennis pros is to help these kids love the sport so much as kids that they will keep playing for the rest of their lives. And they can do so in a way where it's not boring. I just think grinding from the baseline, eventually tennis players just go, God, man, this is just too much work. I got to find something else.
You know, Brent, I think one of the things that is most amusing to me is to watch Federer play one of these knuckle-dragging full Western players. And he'll get a kind of a short ball, and then he'll just hit that little chip, kind of short to the backhand side. And then I love the helpless look that the knuckle-dragger gets on his face when he realizes he has to run 20 feet forward to try to scrape a ball off the ground, only to know that he's going to pop it up right to Federer's forehand for the easy winner cross court. You know, and then, you know, conversely, you see that playful look on Federer's face like, there's, you know, I know I can win a point almost any time I want. You know, all he has to do is wait. He just waits for the short ball, makes that little chip. I won't name the American player that I saw him do that against, but that particular player I don't think has ever won more than two games in a set off Federer, but a very big Western grip guy. So,
I don't think we're setting the kids up right. I mean, I'll never forget I had a parent come in, you know, years ago when I was at Cal Club and was not really a tennis player, and so I can't fault them for their thinking, but their thought was, well, you know, what do you mean that, you know, you can't teach my son to play like and he wasn't sure what the name was. You mean Rafa? And I just said, yeah, you know, I just don't teach that way. Well, why not? I mean, if it's not good enough for Rafa, then what's going on? And I just said, I tried to give him, you know, my little sales pitch and why, and I finally looked at him. I said, you know what, I just don't think we have the right program here for your son. I'm sure there's some other club in San Francisco that would love to be able to, you know, show him how to play just like Rafa. So.
Yeah, exactly. The thing that cracks me up, and I've said this on numerous shows, is you have a kid, and they're maybe going to be 5'6 and about 130 pounds, and they have 11-inch biceps, and they want to play like Rafa. And I'm like, well, you just need your biceps to be about twice as large. And because, you know, his story is largely his physicality. I mean, he's just an incredibly blessed, talented, physical specimen, and with, I believe, a pain tolerance that's off the charts. I think part of Rafa's story is that he has a mental ability to negate pain, nearly inhumane. It's unbelievable. So
I totally agree.
Those traits are not mimicable. Either you have them or you don't. You know, you were either born in that body or you weren't born in that body. You know, so okay. So we have to wrap up here pretty quick here. Now, two questions to wrap this up, and we'll try to make it fairly brief. Okay, is there something that you know about coaching now that you wish you had known at the beginning of your coaching career?
To have the confidence that I don't have to add something to someone's game. I really feel, Bill, that my job now is to really analyze the technique of a player and to be able to try to eliminate, try to take things away, a little bit like a surgeon trying to eliminate unnecessary stuff that gets in the way of a player being able to consistently go through, you know, a set of fundamentals. And I think the other thing that I would do that I used not to do is I would teach much more. In fact, what I do now when I get a new student, and I'm not talking about a pure beginner, I'm talking about someone who's played for a little bit, and someone will, you know, say, hey, Brent, I really need help on my forehand. And what I say is, all right, well, what's your skill level? And they'll tell me, well, I'm a 4-0. And I go, okay, the way I teach is I'm going to arrange for another 4-0, someone you don't know who's got the same skill level rating. I'm going to bring them out. You guys are going to play for 45 minutes, and I'm going to videotape for 45 minutes, and I'm going to say very little in those first 45 minutes, and I'm going to see if really the forehand is the problem. And lots of times I find that it's not the forehand. It's something else that they're doing that is really sort of keeping them or sort of puts their forehand under pressure where now they can't execute it. And so I'm going much more from a standpoint of trying to look at a player play first and see what they do, as opposed to someone comes and says, well, I need work on my forehand. I'll pull out the feeding basket and start, you know, working on technique. Well, most of the time, that doesn't translate to what's really happening when they play their league matches or when they play in tournaments.
Yeah, that's great. Okay, so we have less than 3 minutes left, and, you know, I want to make a comment on what you just said, and then we're gonna try to wrap this thing up. But one of the things that's been resonating with me a lot lately in my reading and the things I'm studying is how the greatest servants of people are tremendous listeners. And so I would say that what you're doing is you're actually listening to the player better than what they're able to tell you, because they tell you one thing, but then you're watching and you're observing, and you're really reading and listening to what's really true. So hats off to you. I think that's great, and I don't know how I'm going to incorporate that into my own teaching, but I've got to find a way. Now, we've got about in 1 minute. How would you summarize this conversation so that there were like one or two or three points that people come away with?
Well, in terms of my own teaching and what I've learned from Tom Stowe about how to teach and about how to play, it's really trying to help a player, and that player could be yourself if you're, you know, trying to improve your own play. How do you eliminate the stuff that's getting in the way of you being consistent? And the only way to do it sometimes is with getting someone else to really be looking for those things that don't help you with the execution of a stroke.
Mm-hmm.
And I would hope that the takeaway today, especially for coaches and teachers, would be start working on being more of a minimalist in terms of helping your players eliminate the unnecessary stuff, and trust that you don't have to over-deliver. You don't have to add layers and layers of all this stuff in terms of mechanics on someone to make you feel like you're worth your, you know, you're worth $100 or whatever you're charging.
Yeah, that's great. So, hey, thank you so much for coming on the show, Brent. If someone wanted to reach out to you, do you have an email address that they could send you an email?
Sure. The best way to get me is Brent at webtennis, webtennis.com.
Okay, terrific. Hey, thanks so much. fun. It's very challenging for me, and I appreciate it, and I'm sure that our listeners are going to really enjoy listening to this.
Thanks for having me on, Bill.
All right, take care. All right. So, wow, Brent, that was very deep and excellent. So, folks, as you may be aware, I'm also doing some life coaching as well as coaching of coaches and parents of coaches. Parents of players. And you can reach me now at infinitecoach.org@gmail.com, infinitecoach.org@gmail.com, which, of course, my website address is embedded in that. So, anyway, thanks for listening, and hope that you will definitely listen to all the shows on the UR Tennis Network. I definitely am seeing that people are listening to previous episodes of this show as well as the others, so keep it up. All right? So that's it for today, and as is my custom, I will leave you with this.
Opinions stated by various contributors to the UR Tennis Network and its programming are not to be considered as endorsed by the UR Tennis Network. Participants are encouraged to use their own discernments and draw their own conclusions. All information, products, and services offered by the UR Tennis Network are for personal use only. The UR Tennis Network does not confirm nor deny the validity or accuracy of information contained within the network. Any products or services provided for should be used solely for entertainment purposes. We emphasize the idea of keeping an open mind and not construing the products, services, or data as factual.